So how do characteristic properties such as heat flow, mean velocity, or characteristic magnetic field strengths vary with the control parameters? And of course, very interesting question is, does the dynamo regime change between parameter values that are accessible in the numerical simulations and the true planetary values? And often, of course, you're suspicious about values that are many orders of magnitude off and whether numerical dynamos are very strongly influenced by viscosity in contrast to planetary models. And towards the end of my talk, I will come to the questions if planetary dynamos and at least some stellar dynamos follow the same scaling rules. The basic hypothesis that we have used to analyze our numerical data is that diffusive processes, which are described by kinematic viscosity, thermal diffusivity, and magnetic diffusivity, which are supposed to not play a first-order role, possibly in planetary dynamos, that this kind of regime where the diffusivities become rather unimportant is already approached in present-day geodynamo models. So brief outlines of the type of models here. So we solve the Boussinesq, the incompressible equations for convection-driven MHD flow in rapidly rotating spherical shells. In all of our models, we use rigid inner and outer boundaries. The shell is rather deep, as is suitable for the Earth's core geometry. And in all the models, we use the fixed temperature contrast between inner and outer boundary. Now, this is a rather simple model, and still it has at least four control parameters that you may want to vary. And because there are three diffusivities in the problem, three of these four control parameters must depend on diffusivities. And these are the Ekman number and the two Prandtl numbers. With a fourth parameter, we are free to define it in such a way that it is independent of all the diffusivities. And what we use is what we call a modified Rayleigh number, where basically buoyancy forces are compared to rotational forces. And this modified Rayleigh number, by the way, in the astrophysics community is, except for the power 2 here, the same what's called the convected Rossby number, usually. And now, if our hypothesis is correct that diffusivities don't play a big role, then we want to find scaling laws between these control parameters, in particular between the modified Rayleigh number that is independent of the viscosity, and non-dimensional parameters that describe the model result in terms of velocity or heat flow or magnetic field. And these non-dimensional diagnostic numbers, there we also want to pick some that don't relate to any of the diffusivities. So to describe velocity, we pick the Rossby number. The magnetic field, for the magnetic field, we define something we call the Lorentz number. You can think of it in terms of comparing alpha in velocity to the velocity of rotation. And also for the heat transport, we define a modified Nusselt number, which also doesn't refer to thermal conductivity. There's one more point. Although our model simulations are conducted in a way that it's driven by a fixed temperature contrast, so the original control parameter is a Rayleigh number or modified Rayleigh number based on this temperature contrast, we like to analyze our results based on a flux-based modified Rayleigh number that we get simply by multiplying the temperature-based Rayleigh number with the modified Nusselt number. And there are a couple of reasons why we want to do this, even though this is not the original control parameter. For one, for the real planetary application, we have really no good idea on what the driving super adiabatic temperature or entropy contrast is, whereas we have some reasonable idea on what the convected heat flow may be. The second point is this heat flux-based Rayleigh number actually turns up if you try to derive scaling laws by just force balance arguments, to which I will come later. So it's rather the flux that turns up rather than temperature contrast. And finally, a very nice thing of this flux-based Stored Rayleigh number is that in the non-dimensional units that we use, it's directly proportional to the work done by the buoyancy forces in the flow. So it's a direct measure for the power driving the whole system. Okay, let's start with results. In the next couple of slides, I will show similar diagrams. So here we plot usually y against x for a large set of numerical dynamo models. And let me briefly explain the symbols. So we distinguish different Ekman numbers by the shape of the symbol, and we cover a range of three orders of magnitude, from 10 to the minus 6 to 10 to the minus 3. Different magnetic Prandtl numbers are color-coded, where red stands for values larger than 1, and blue for values lower than 1, and, well, the more deep blue is even lower than the more light blue, and so on. And finally, in most of these cases, the kinetic Prandtl number is 1, but we also changed the ordinary Prandtl number within some range between 0.1 and 10, and different values are indicated by additional little circle or cross inside the main symbol. So overall, we have about 80 or 90 of these dynamos. And so in this slide, we look at heat transfer efficiency. Of course, if you just plot Nusselt number against Rayleigh number, you would get widely different results depending on the Ekman number, because we all know as you speed up the rotation, convection is inhibited. And so at the same Rayleigh number, you get very different Nusselt numbers. You can collapse the results to some degree by plotting the Nusselt number against the Rayleigh number normalized by the critical value for the onset of non-magnetic convection. But still, there is quite some scatter. Now, if we move to the start variables, or call it diffusionless parameters, the start Nusselt number and the start flux-based Rayleigh number, all the results collapse fairly well on a very clearly defined line, which actually has a quite steep slope, which in this diagram is a little bit larger than 0.5. So this seems to confirm our basic idea that using these diffusionless parameters actually can explain, at least in this case for the heat flow, can explain very well these dependencies, and that diffusion, viscosity and diffusion actually seem to play a small role. Now we have discussed this a couple of weeks ago here in the Dynamo program, and one objection or caveat has been, well, by using these flux-based Rayleigh number, actually what we do is we take the normal Rayleigh number, multiply it by the Nusselt number, and in this way you generate really a very great spread on both, but basically here on the x-axis, and any fit will look quite good. So here I compare, we can do the same exercise for the temperature-based Rayleigh number. So first of all, the slope becomes even larger than 1, so a very steep slope between Nusselt and Rayleigh number. The fit is still good, maybe not quite as perfect, and you may also notice that a few points, like these light blue triangles up here, seem to start to deviate away from this fitting line. The explanation for that is, I tried to give it here in this type of cartoon, which shows just a log of Rayleigh number, the normal Rayleigh number, the ordinary Rayleigh number against log of Nusselt number. And what you expect in the non-rotating case is to lie along this line, which has a slope of about 2/7 or something like that. In the rotating case, well, you will inhibit convection, so the critical value of the Rayleigh number becomes much larger. Then in a rotating sphere, first we observe this very sluggish increase. However, once convection has filled the entire spherical shell, then the heat flow rises very steeply. And this is for, well, a low ECMA number, and if you lower the ECMA number even further, you will shift everything, but basically replicate this otherwise. There's an interesting poster by Eric King and others which deals with these issues. So the interpretation is that basically our numerical dynamos are in this on this branch here, and by going to the start variables, we actually collapse these curves into one. However, for some of our models, we actually start to approach this regime where rotational forces are no longer so dominant, for example, compared to inertial forces, and therefore we start to see these deviations. Okay, next point is scaling of velocities. Let's start here with some fairly simple force balance considerations. Let's take the vorticity equation and compare, well, the inertial term, buoyancy term, and the Coriolis term. What's absent here is Lorentz forces. And, well, in a first very simple attempt, we can say, okay, we assume simply some relevant length scale, a mixing length here, and then balance the inertial term and the buoyancy, buoyancy term, just assuming a length scale. So what we get for the inertial term then here is u squared, where capital U is the characteristic velocity, divided by length scale squared. And for the buoyancy term, we get well, thermal expansivity, gravity, then the temperature fluctuation, delta T, divided by the length scale. Now, if you multiply this with capital U, then we get here U and times temperature fluctuations. And if they are correlated, of course, this gives us, aside from heat capacity density, gives us just the convected heat flow. And so we multiply this equation on both sides with capital U, replace delta T by the heat flow, and some of these other thermodynamic parameters we can combine into the temperature scale height, and we get a prediction that the velocity varies as the heat flow to the 1/3 power. Or translated into our non-dimensional parameters, the Rossby number goes like the flux Rayleigh number to the 1/3 power. Of course, we all think Coriolis forces are important. So the next step is to consider a triple force balance and determine, rather than assuming a length scale, determining the length scale from a balance between Coriolis and inertia force. And the important point here is that if we look at the Coriolis term, it in the vorticity equation, it involves the variation of velocity with a z variable, and in a strongly rotating system, we are close to a Proudman-Taylor state. So the length scale here is more global length scale rather than a small length scale in the horizontal direction. And we assume in the Coriolis term we have a global length scale. We then get from the balance the small length scale in the horizontal direction. We can insert this length scale over here. And in this case, the prediction is velocity goes like heat flow to the 2/5 power with some weak dependence on the rotation rate. And in terms of the non-dimensional parameters, Rossby number goes like the 2/5 power of the Rayleigh number. Things become a bit more, well, the question is, what is this global length scale? In the Business case, it's simply the shell thickness or something like that, or the radius of the sphere. Things become a bit more complicated when there are strong density stratifications that, of course, we don't consider in the numerical models. But if they are there, the Corillis term looks a little bit more complicated, and actually what comes in is a density scale height. And in this case, we have to replace the density scale height rather than shell thickness. Okay, now what do the numerical data tell us? So this is again plot Rossby number against the starred flux Rayleigh number. And just an unconstrained fit gives us an exponent of 0.41, so very close to 2/5. Just for comparison, I've plotted here this light blue line is a 1/3 slope, so clearly this doesn't seem to fit the data very well. So what's perhaps surprising is that the data are fitted really well by this 2/5 law with little influence of the magnetic field. There may be a weak influence, for example, if you look at the dark blue points, which are very low magnetic Prandtl numbers, and the red points, which are very high magnetic Prandtl numbers. There seems to be some systematic deviation, but it's not too strong in this case. So a little bit surprising is that Lorentz forces don't seem to play a big role in to determine the velocities. Of course, the most interesting point, perhaps, is what determines the strength of the magnetic field. At least as far as planetary dynamos go, kind of paradigm, David Stevenson mentioned that, is that it's typically assumed that the flow is in a kind of magnetostrophic balance, so Corillis forces and Lorentz forces are of the same order, and it's assumed that the Elsasser number, defined here, is a good measure of the ratio of Corillis and Lorentz forces and should be of order 1. Now what's plotted here is the Elsasser number for our numerical models. It's plotted against the magnetic Reynolds number, but that's not important. The essential point here is this wide spread that we get for the Elsasser number, varying between less than 0.1 up to 100. So, well, you can, of course, argue what order 1 means, if it will allow two orders of magnitude on both sides, but, well, it doesn't look too convincing. And so either the force balance in these dynamos is not magnetostrophic, or perhaps this Elsasser number isn't really a good measure for the Corillis-Lorentz force balance. Okay, what we look at is just the alternative approach. Is perhaps the field strength basically controlled by the available power? Again, let's start with some scaling arguments. So the work done by buoyancy forces, of course, is given by, just for a little parcel of rising or sinking fluid, the density contrast, which depends on delta T, gravity force, and the radial velocity. And of course, this term here is the same what you get for the heat flow, so it's closely related to the advected heat flow. Basically, it's heat or volumetric flux, you would call it in astrophysics, divided by the temperature scale height. Now, this power now is available to convert it into kinetic and magnetic energy, and ultimately it will be dissipated again. And we call this F ohm the fraction of ohmic dissipation, which is less than 1. Typically in our dynamo models, this fraction is between 30 and 80% of the total is ohmic dissipation. Okay, next we define a dissipation time, which is simply the ratio of magnetic energy density, or magnetic energy and ohmic dissipation. Or if you want, you can just related to the length scale at which magnetic field is dissipated, length scale squared divided by eta. And now comes an assumption in. We assume that this ohmic dissipation time goes like magnetic diffusion time times magnetic Reynolds number to the minus 1. Or in terms of the length scale of magnetic dissipation, it would go like Rm to the minus 1/2. And of course, if you write it, it's just then the length scale divided by U. This kind of assumption, however, Andreas Tilden and myself have looked at that for dynamo models a couple of years ago, and we found that such kind of relation actually fits at least the model data fairly well. Now, if we use this and just write our magnetic energy density as, this factor here, then the available power times the ohmic dissipation time, we come up with this expression here. So it should go like the advected heat flow. And now, of course, we have to make a choice for the velocity u here. And if the typical velocity goes like heat flow to the 1/3 power, we end up, so this comes from mixing length theory, we end up with a very interesting scaling law for the magnetic energy. Interesting in the sense that, well, it depends on heat flow to the 2/3 power, but is independent of rotation. If we rather take the velocity scaling law from the triple force balance, which was also confirmed by comparing directly with the numerical simulations, so the 2/5 power, we get at a little bit more complicated expression here with q to the 3/5 and a weak dependence on rotation rate with 1/5 power. In terms of non-dimensional parameters, it means that the Lorentz number with some correction for ohmic dissipation goes with the flux Rayleigh number to the 1/3 power in one case and with an exponent 3/10 in the other case. Okay, what do the numerical data, the model data tell us? Again, the best fitting line here has a slope that is very close to 1/3. It's 0.338, the best fit here. And so this seems to suggest that B may actually be quite independent of rotation rate. If we compare it with the other exponent, 0.3, which is again the blue line, well, yeah, marginal, maybe, yeah, not so bad. There's a little problem there, of course, because the 1/3 scaling exponent should go along with the 1/3 scaling also for the velocity, which we don't find. However, there may be ways around, because the scaling for the Rossby number, or for capital U here, describes the RMS velocity, and which goes, we find, like U to the 2/5. This may not be really the relevant velocity that takes the magnetic field towards the dissipation scale. So a little bit depending, perhaps, on the precise spectra of kinetic energy or velocity as function of wave number, Perhaps the global mean velocity may be not exactly the velocity that is relevant for taking magnetic field to the dissipation scale. Okay, now how does it compare with what we know about the Earth? Well, for the Earth, we don't know the magnetic field inside the core very well, but the know it roughly at the core mantle boundary, and inside the core it should be larger by a factor between 3 or 5 or 10, something like that. So if I estimate for the RMS field inside the Earth's core 1 to 3 millitesla, then I assume that most or almost all of the dissipation is ohmic. And if I assume that the total advected flux is in this range, which are typical numbers that you find in the literature, Actually, this is a kind of effective value, because from the total heat flux, first we have to subtract, Dave Stevenson talked about it, what you can conduct along an adiabatic gradient, which is a very substantial part. But then probably you have to increase it if you want to talk about an effective flux. You have to increase it again for to account for chemical convection. But so this is probably a reasonable range of numbers. And if we stick this in and then determine what is the stored flux Rayleigh number and what is the Lorentz number, we end up in this little gray square here. Up here are our dynamo models. So in terms of these parameters, we are still some orders of magnitude away, but not very many orders of magnitude away in terms of these variables here. So perhaps it's not too bad to extrapolate things, and it seems to fit the Earth. The blue broken line, again, is an exponent of 0.3 rather than 1/3. Well, this probably would fit as well. Okay, well, so far the fits looked quite nice. Actually, I got a comment a couple of weeks ago that they seem so perfect, you can't believe it. Now, this tempted me to show a fit that's not very good. But it's a relevant question that, in particular, astrophysicists are excited about. That's the energy partitioning, so magnetic to kinetic energy. This ratio, in terms of my non-dimensional parameters, fortunately, is just the Lorentz number squared divided by Rossby number squared. And if I take my scaling laws that I found so far for these two, I find it should go like something like the flux Rayleigh number to the minus 2 over 15. So a rather weak dependence, but as you go to low flux Lorentz numbers, it should increase. Or if you prefer to express it in terms of a convected Rossby number, the exponent is a little bit larger. So as you lower the convective Rossby number, the prediction is this energy ratio should increase. Now for the Earth's core, the start flux Rayleigh number is of order 10 to the minus 13, and if you stick this in here, we end up with energy ratio of 100, so strong super equipartitioning. Now here are just magnetic to kinetic energy plotted against this flux Rayleigh number from the numerical simulations. The scatter now is really big. Why is that? I mean, for Lorentz number and Rossby number individually, the scatter was really small. However, the exponents for both are fairly similar, 2/5 and 1/3. So if you divide them one by the other, and the residual exponent becomes weak, like these 2/15. Also, you take the square of it, and so you really blow up the residual errors that are there. And, well, what does it tell us? The slope that just put in a best fit here, that's not too bad. It doesn't agree completely, but it's roughly in the same ballpark as this exponent. However, what's really embarrassing is that there seems to be a very systematic dependence on the magnetic Prandtl number. The blue points, low magnetic Prandtl number, plot significantly lower than the red points. Unfortunately, it's not possible to run low magnetic Prandtl number calculations over here. Well, there's one point for the ECMA number 10 to the minus 6 with a magnetic Prandtl number less than 1, which falls up there, but obviously there are still some problems to fully understand the influence of the magnetic Prandtl number in these dynamo simulations. So basically, yeah, what we need is to do more work to better understand actually this magnetic Prandtl number problem. Well, so far I've talked just about mean properties. So what about the magnetic field morphology or topology? Basically, we find two classes of solutions to make things simple. One is a dipolar and the other is a multipolar class. what this shows is, well, example of the radial magnetic field. Here's at full resolution, down here, filtered to low pass filter to low wavelengths. And yesterday, Radostin Zimitev also talked about these two classes. And so far, our scaling analysis, for the scaling analysis, we only picked the dipolar solutions. We ignored the multipolar solutions. Okay. And it turns out that rotation, or more precisely, the ratio of rotational to inertial forces seems to play the major role to determine the type of dynamo. What this shows here is, of course, this is measured by a kind of Rossby number. We call it the local Rossby number. We calculated it with a kind of mean length scale from the kinetic energy spectrum. There are other ways to calculate it, like averaging vorticity in the flow, which probably gives a very similar result. And what's plotted here is this local Rossby number, and here this is the ratio of dipole field to total field strength at the outer boundary. So this is a degree of dipolarity, if you want. At low values of the local Rossby number, the points up here, we find a very strong dipole contribution. And there seems to be almost like a first-order transition here at values of the local Rossby number that exceed something like 0.12. We get these guys down here, multipolar dynamo solutions. Zimitev also talked about hysteresis. So far, we didn't look very carefully, but so far we found only a single case of hysteresis. These are these two points connected by the broken line. There it depends really on the initial condition, what we get, the dipolar or the multipolar solution. But it seems, this local Rossby number actually determines where you go. Now, how do we relate this local Rossby number, in contrast to the global Rossby number, about which I talked so far, to the basic control parameters? We again tried our fitting exercise, and unfortunately, it turned out that this local Rossby number, we could only fit it if we assume a dependence on all four control parameters. Too bad. Anyway, now what we did is a wild extrapolation. Of course, some of these parameters are far from Earth, to obtain the Earth value, and what came out? For the Earth's core, we predict a local Rossby number of order 0.1, which is just close to the transition point. And this shows similar thing, only represented slightly differently. Again, the local Rossby number. What's plotted here now is a Lorentz number for the dipole field alone, normalized by the one-third power law. And So up here, we get all these dipolar solutions. We satisfy, we have normalized the dependence on the Rayleigh number, we have normalized it out, and we find this rather sharp transition to dipole moments, which are at least an order of magnitude below here. I already mentioned Earth plots somewhere up here, close to the transition point, and we may speculate this is the reason why you get dipole reversals on Earth. Because sometimes Earth may lapse into the multipolar regime, and then if the dipole recovers, it can have either polarity. For the other planets, extrapolations and assumptions are even more wild, but anyway, if we do it, the big gas planets plot somewhere here. So Jupiter and Saturn safely in the dipolar regime, so they may never reverse. Dave Stevens told us that Uranus and Neptune are not really dipolar dynamos. Too bad that they plot so far over here. So that's not the explanation. But Mercury probably may fit into this diagram. Okay, in the last 5 minutes or so, I want to talk about the question, could these scaling laws also apply to stars? Well, obvious problem with the Sun is we have heard a lot about the Tachocline, which may lead to a fundamentally different dynamo. Then, of course, for the solar field, we know that large scales, the dipole isn't dominant, and, well, we know pretty well that rotation plays much less of a role than in planets. So, but one may ask, what about fully convective stars? These are low-mass stars and rapidly rotating stars. Would they perhaps agree? Again, a similar diagram as before, but again, slightly different. Again, local Rossby number here. What's plotted now here is the Lorentz number describing not the dipole, but the mean surface field. So something like the mean unsigned magnetic flux, if you want, at the surface. Again, normalized by the power. And again, basically, you see these two regimes up here, pretty constant. And here, something that, well, if you want, may show this rather strong decrease as you increase the local Rossby number or decrease rotation rate. In the talk by Matthias Rempel, from whom I got this slide, you have seen this already. What's plotted here is, in a log scale, the X-ray flux for a huge set of different stars. And the X-ray flux is a proxy for maybe the mean magnetic field strength at the surface of the star, plotted against rotation period. And qualitatively, we see fairly similar things. At slow rotation, the magnetic field strength increases with rotation rate, but then some saturation occurs at some point. And so this may be pretty similar. We don't know, of course, for sure if this goes along with a drastic change in the topology of the field from small scale to large scale or dipolar up here, but it may be so. Interesting result. So far, I've found only a single result where using Zeeman-Doppler imaging, a low-mass, rapidly rotating star has been, or the attempt to determine the morphology of the magnetic field. So this is the star V374 Pegasi, which is a star with about a little bit less than 0.3 solar masses. Rapid rotation period. The field strength at the surface is large, 1 kilogauss. There's little differential rotation. And this shows the magnetic field morphology. We look here on one of the poles. And so the black ring here is the equator. And this shows the radial magnetic field. We don't really see the other poles. It goes, I think, to 45 or 60 degrees here. But it looks pretty dipole dominated. So actually, there may be strong but dipole-dominated magnetic fields in such kind of objects. Okay, now to extend our scaling law to these stars, the problem is our models were all Boussinesq, but these objects, of course, they cover very many density scale heights in the dynamo region. So we tried to generalize it along the following lines. We start out again with our scaling result, magnetic energy density goes like, well, density to the 1/3, heat flow to the, which would here be bolometric luminosity, to the 2/3, then there's a length scale and the temperature scale height. Now what we do, and of course there's a constant of proportionality. This constant of proportionality we take from our view dynamo models and assume this doesn't change. Of course, then we have to deal with the strong variations in density, in the scale heights, and so on. And what we take is a stellar model, which gives us for 0.3 or something solar mass star, which gives us density, bolometric flux, radiative flux, which of course we have to subtract, and the variation of scale heights. Finally, this length scale, which in case of the geodynamo models was a global length scale. Here we assume, well, depending on the kind of object we consider, it's the smaller of the density scale height or the global length scale. So usually in stars, it's the density scale height here. And then we have to do some averaging, of course, to get some characteristic magnetic field strengths. And we simply assume, well, let's take this equation and just take a volume average using the stellar model for getting the radial dependencies. And so the final result we write in terms of a mean magnetic energy here and mean density, volumetric flux at the surface of the star, and all the averaging we consume into this, let's call it an efficiency factor F, which comes out of the stellar model if we do the averaging. Well, we do this exercise, well, for stars, for Jupiter, taking Guyot models, and the Earth's core, where it's simple because things don't vary almost not at all. And a little bit surprising, I would expect it much larger differences. Actually, these efficiency factors don't vary a lot between these different objects. They're always order one. Well, there's a final point. What this scaling theory gives us is a mean magnetic field strength inside the dynamo. We must relate it somehow to what you observe at the surface of this object. And, well, there I have a poor idea for stars. Basically, what we did is just take relations between the internal field strength and the surface, mean field strength or the surface dipole field strength, that we get from our models. Of course, there we may be wrong by perhaps quite some factor, but that's all what we have. So to get the surface field strength, we scale it up. If it's a total flux or unsigned flux by this factor between 2.5 and 5, that's what our models tell us. And if we take the dipole between 4 and 10. Okay, and that's the final result. So at the bottom, it's this mean density to the 1/3, surface volumetric flux to the 2/3, and this efficiency factor. And this is the mean magnetic energy density inside the object. Well, these are Earth and Jupiter. Earth I showed before, nothing new about here. This, of course, is just the line, assuming our scaling and taking the constant of proportionality from the numerical models. And up here, well, first of all, we took this V374 Pegasi, where we know or have reason to assume it's a global dipolar field is present, taking the field strength and applying this factor between 4 and 10 to relate the surface field strength to the internal one, and then it plots over there. We also took a set of 13 rapidly rotating M stars from a study of Reiners and Basri, where the mean unsigned surface flux was determined by a novel technique using molecular FEH lines, doing spectroscopy on them and determining surface field strengths, which also are in the range from 1 to 4 or 5 kilogauss, and doing the same exercise, they are this broader light gray range here. So they overlap quite well. So although many assumptions enter here about, well, how you do exactly the averaging when you get strong density stratification and how do you relate surface fields to internal fields, obviously this can give only order of magnitude estimates, but for that it really looks maybe too good for someone here. Okay. I guess I don't read this and leave time for discussion.
So we do have time for discussion. Who would like to start?
Yes, how much do your prediction agree with a numerical experiment of convection? I wasn't sure because, for example, in a very large Rayleigh number convection experiment, not non-rotating, I think the law Nusselt versus Rayleigh is with exponent 0.5. This is a hard turbulence regime. Do you see anything of this?
In the non-rotating regime?
Yes.
Well, all our numerical models are in a rapidly rotating regime.
But at some point, it seems that you were going toward a line.
Yeah, but this seems to be fairly transitional, and this is still not into the inertial regime. So I can't really tell because it's at most transitional to the inertial regime.
start of your stars section, you showed a plot of the Lorentz number against the Rossby number, which had a suggestive slope with more rapid rotation than a saturation. What's different in that plot from your earlier plot of Lorentz number with Rossby number, where there's more of a step function transition?
The step function was for the dipole part.
Okay.
The two diagrams differed. In one, I showed the dipole part alone at the surface, and in the other diagram, I showed the total RMS field. And the character of the field changes almost step-like from one which is dominated by the dipole, so it makes up 50% of the energy, to one where the dipole is really weak, let's say 5% or less of the energy. And so this is rather step-like, but the total energy, including the small scales, this seems to change more gradually.
And those are all for the Boussinesq geodynamo-motivated
simulations. These were all Boussinesq geodynamo-type simulations, yes.
I would like to ask you a question. So I think there is one thing which is a bit different from the way we are computing our model, from the way you are computing it, yours in the geodynamo, knowing that from the benchmark we are doing right now. It's the fact that you seem, when you're increasing your Rayleigh number, you are not fixing the luminosity of your model. So I'm wondering, we have a constraint on the luminosity of the Earth, I guess, what will be the equivalent of a luminosity, perhaps, because in the star, we know that this is fixed. So when you increase the Rayleigh number, you have this constraint that you see. So it seems to me that this Nusselt scaling and how the Rayleigh number varies with the parameters, we can less do that in a star because we know what is luminosity. So I have a bit of... I think that's fundamentally different.
Well, it's perhaps a little bit different in culture. So, you may do this as an exercise in, call it, basic fluid or basic magnetohydrodynamics. Imagine fancy planets that rotate much slower than real planets do and are much more viscous and so on, and then vary all the parameters. So it's more in this spirit this is done. Of course, there are also for planets there are constraints, maybe not so strong on the luminosity, which would be the advected heat flow there. And of course, there are constraints, but we all have to cheat on something. We must make all the diffusivities far too large and call it turbulent values. Maybe we have to rotate it too slowly. I think it's a little bit different angle of attack, but basically it should give consistent results in the end.
One thing you might consider doing once you establish these laws, or for instance with traditional non-rotating heat transfer data, typically once a law is established, you'll then make another plot where you normalize the data by your expected law.
Sure.
And so that might be, in a sense, a nice way to double check, because you're stretching out, as people have said, you're stretching out the data by Ekman to the minus... or Ekman cubed, so by a huge amount. So maybe once you establish one of these laws, you might want to then plot Nusselt star times whatever you're getting, Rayleigh Q star to 0.5.
In a way,
it'll go to one, yeah. Or you'll see all these separate data sets maybe don't go to that law.
Well, sure. This is typically will reveal, let's call it, secondary dependencies aside from the basic law. And
I don't know if that's the case. Yeah.
Yeah, and the example we're looking at the partitioning of energies is wasn't exactly what you proposed, but a little bit similar. It showed where actually problems still are.
I think that would be relieving.
Okay.
One comment on this Ekman stretching out. It's true, of course, by multiplying with Ekman to the third power and covering in a range for the Ekman number of three orders of magnitude, you stretch out this axis tremendously. So you may hide in this way some subtle dependencies. However, what it shows is that for different Ekman numbers, you can actually collapse things very nicely.
numerical value for Nusselt star, Rayleigh Q star, goes as has a one-half law. So actually, the critical value is close to the law you're getting. It might actually be, if we're not careful, that the law above critical is different from that. And you're naturally seeing 0.5 because that's how the critical value scales itself. And so if your actual heat transfer is not incredibly different from that, you'll naturally see about 0.5. So I just think we should be careful there.
Yeah, there's no, I agree, but...
Two final questions, Lord and Andy. Oh, three final questions. Okay. Make them quick.
Uli, since we are kind of at the end of this conference, I was trying to make the link between your wonderful results and what we had earlier in the week on this small-scale dynamo inertial ranges and so on. One naive view would be that since the diffusivities do not enter the scaling laws you have, they should apply to cases in which you don't have just one single length scale as you have defined here, but a range of length scales and scales for the magnetic field and so on. So is it then you'd think that you'd actually get some predictions on this kind of power laws of spectra rather of the different objects which even should get you could get from the scaling laws themselves. Is it something that you've thought about and what would be the implications for this type of...
I'm not sure if I fully understand what you mean, but I mean, I was very careful here to restrict the analysis to these large-scale dipolar dynamos. Mm-hmm. And I, if I include the non-dipolar ones, which for most of these diagrams I showed I've thrown out, then the scatter really becomes larger and it may... There may be dependencies on diffusivities. I can't.
But you think you can't really link the things with. When you extrapolate to Earth like conditions, of course you go several orders of magnitude on some parameters, not all of them, and that you've showed. But that means that for some of the length scales, for example, you start, or the magnetic field, you start entering a regime in which you have a distribution over very many scales. And that's not directly apparent in your scaling laws. You have just one dominant length scale. So you think that it's somewhat related to this sum, that you have to pick one in the spectrum, which is the one which counts, which already, I think, would be some information on the behavior of these things.
Uli, perhaps I didn't understand what you were doing in your comparison with the Earth, but you gave a figure of 2 to 8 terawatts for the superadiabatic heat flow through the Earth, and I'm not sure how you know that number. However, do you? anyway, it could be just tiny. You had in your paper with Andreas, you gave a value of 0.5 terawatts for the dissipation, and you also take F ohm to be a factor of 1 here. So,
isn't
there
a
great inconsistency here?
There's still an efficiency factor, which I mean, 0.5. I mean, this is in the paper with Andreas. I actually took the our preferred estimate would actually be at the lower end of these.
0.2.
Would be around 2, and then if you translate it into ohmic, this is a heat flow, so you still have a Carnot factor in between. So which brings you down to less than 1 for the ohmic dissipation. But, I mean, if you look into the literature, other people like Francis Nimmo, they usually like rather larger superadiabatic heat flows, 5 or even more. So I prefer to take the whole range here in this comparison. Actually, the agreement is better if I restrict it, if I cut the range, or say, 2 to 4. Okay, but I
could you briefly comment?
No, I don't.
With regards to the results of Gary Latzmeyer's, whether they agree, in first of all, with respect to cycles, I think he finds occasionally reversals, stochastic reversals. Do you have those reversals? And where on your plot of B field versus Rayleigh number, where the Earth was and your models were? It does carry its model.
Well, maybe Peter Olsen will talk more about that later, but, well, since you ask me, it's not really, it's the local Rossby number which counts, and reversing dynamos are found close to this transition point at local Rossby numbers that are close to the transition between these two regimes.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Let's thank Uli again.